Hello, and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental nerds, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, Nick and I discuss annual reviews. We talk to Ethan Brown about curiosity, climate change, engagement, and the Sweaty Penguin podcast. And finally, penguins are flightless, but they do leap into the air prior to diving. The move releases air bubbles from their feathers, reducing drag and doubling or tripling their speed underwater. They do the reverse, coming out of the water, sometimes launching themselves 9 feet into the air.
Yeah, how about that?
I can picture them going in the water. I can't picture them coming out of the water.
It's like torpedoes. They're like, zoof. That's the sound they make, I think. Exactly that sound. It's really cool. Penguins are great. They smell terrible, but they look, they're cool.
They only smell terrible when they're packed together in hundreds in a zoo.
Yeah, that's fair.
Hit that music.
The International Association for Impact Assessment will be hosting their annual conference May 8th through 11th in Malaysia this year. If you are able to attend, please check it out at www.iaia.org for more details.
All righty. We don't have a sponsor, so you're ready to do our 30 seconds or less sponsor joke?
Oh, gosh.
Because 1, 2, 3, go.
What's it called? Yeah. Okay. So, wow. Would you like to be a vulture, but everyone thinks you're an eagle? Welcome to the Crested Caracara, the bird of birds. Today's sponsor is that bird because it is absolutely 100% a vulture, but looks exactly like an eagle. That's what we call PR, folks. And the show is sponsored by that bird. There we go. I did it.
Now accepting sponsor applications at www.environmentalprofessionalsradio.com.
Let's get to our segment. Okay, so Sam's asking us a question about evaluations. When we do them, how often, and does it matter or does it change based on privately or with the state or a federal government? And the answer is yes. It's whatever you think is correct. There are official evaluations. Most companies, I would say, do a yearly evaluation as the, I guess, bare minimum. Maybe standard. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of companies that just do a once a year, you know, this time frame, January-ish time frame evaluation. And they go, this is what you did great. This is what you did poorly. Do better, do worse, whatever. Here it is. Feedback's one of the most important things you can get as an employee. So a good company should be giving you feedback when you do well and when you don't. None of that should be a surprise on your big evaluation for, you know, potential raises or promotions or anything like that. And I would also guess that every company does that a little bit differently. I don't know, Laura, what your experience is with that, but that's kind of in a nutshell for me.
Yeah, basically they do all do it differently. There are some similarities. And like you said, most of them have an annual policy. More progressive companies are moved into, you know, more continuous opportunities for feedback. Ideally, any project that you're on, there should be some sort of debrief, an opportunity. The worst case scenario is that you've done something wrong and no one tells you until your annual evaluation 6 months later. And then it's news to you that you've been doing something wrong repeatedly. And then it comes time to see if your review affects your raise. And you're like, I never had a chance to fix this. But the point is that you should be asking for feedback if you're not getting what you need to make sure that you're doing a good job. Doesn't mean that you need to be needy about it. But just to say, hey, you know, is there anything that I could do differently the next time I'm out in the field and you're flying me across the country? And, you know, did you hear anything from the client or the other Nick about how I did or whatever? So like for myself, personal experience, this is often the case too. The intention for the reviews are to be annual, but it keeps getting bumped down in priority by the leadership because their powers that be aren't enforcing them to do it. So you may expect to get an annual review, but you don't actually get one, which is terrible. So again, go get the feedback that you need.
You know, some companies have to have incentives for that, right? Where they have to say literally like, hey, if you don't do your annual reviews with your employees, guess what? You can't get a raise kind of stuff. And it shouldn't be a threat, but sometimes that's the motivation that certain people need to get things done and to make it a priority because it has to be made a priority.
Right. And what I was going to say, so what my boss always did, and I would say, don't let your boss get away with this. My boss would say, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, great. I don't have to hear any actual feedback. He doesn't actually do any work. But then, in my personal case, I find out later, everything that I'm doing is not kosher in the building. So let's make sure that they're giving you real feedback too.
Yeah. And what is it? One of the greatest examples of that is, instead of being like, what am I doing, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, say, give me something I'm doing that I can do better. Give me three things that I can do better. Be specific, because it'll make people answer the question. And, you know, that goes both ways. You know, you should also be providing feedback to your boss. It's one of the things that I've tried to like insist on. It's like, look, I know we're a good group. We get along great. Doesn't mean we can't be better. Please give me something that I can work on too. So, you know, that's important. It's a two-way street. It should be a back and forth.
It should be. It's not always. So yeah. I would watch that if you don't have a boss who is welcoming the feedback.
Honestly, but like, you know, like we talk about a lot on the show, that's good feedback for you. If your boss is like, I'm doing everything right, that's not good.
Yeah.
That's not somebody you want to work for. It really isn't. Because it should be work with. You know what I mean? Like that's
right.
It's a big difference.
But answering Sam's question, there is an expectation for an annual review. There is an expectation that your boss is going to do a good job at it, but they may not. So pay attention to that and don't do what I do and just accept the poor evaluation, ask for more information and get what you need to better. Like we talked about previously, it's your responsibility to better yourself. And so take that upon yourself to pay attention to how your review is.
Yeah, that's all really good stuff.
Cool. Let's get to our interview.
Hello and welcome back to EPR. Today we have Ethan Brown, the founder and host of the Sweaty Penguin podcast. Welcome, Ethan.
Thanks so much for having me.
So yeah, we're really happy to have you here. And you have dual degrees in film and television and environmental analysis and policy. So how do those two things fit together and what made you get into them?
So I was going to college originally as a film and TV major. I explored some silly films in high school and was like, I want to do this. And my parents were like, have you seen what you made? But I was able to get into Boston University's film and television program. I started taking it a little more seriously after realizing I liked it that much. Kind of around the same time, back in high school, I was learning about climate change. I was finding it to be very important. I found it very scary, but I wasn't finding it interesting. It wasn't something I wanted to learn about. But as a storyteller, I felt like I need to tell important stories. This is a very important one. And so I decided to take a environmental elective my freshman fall in college. And it was in that class that I started to grasp how nuanced climate change is, how it's not just scary doom and gloom headlines, but there's so many different solutions out there. There's angles to these issues that affect not just the environment, but also the economy, health, justice, etc. There was just so much more to it than I realized. And that kind of kickstarted my dual degree in environmental analysis and policy, where I was able to really get into the weeds. And that's formed what is now today my podcast, The Sweaty Penguin.
Yeah. And it's a great, great arc. And so when people ask you what you do, how do you answer that question then? Where do you even start?
Yeah, so I usually lead off with my podcast, The Sweaty Penguin. I'm also a contributor for Young Voices, which is a nonprofit PR talent agency for young political commentators. So I do lots of climate op-ed writing. I'll come onto radio and TV shows and do interviews. So I guess I would use a word like climate reporter or maybe climate commentator. I would not use the word activist because I think a lot of my work is more just presenting facts, presenting options, and letting people think for themselves what solutions they would prefer. But anything along those lines, or climate podcaster, although I think as a white man in podcasting, there's sometimes a small stigma. So I kind of shy away from that a little.
Totally understand. So yeah, well, let's talk about the podcast a little bit. Like, aside from having like one of the best names, I mean, Sweaty Penguin's pretty amazing.
Let's go with the full title though, The Sweaty Penguin, Antarctica's Hottest Podcast. Love it.
Yeah, which is great. It's been going for like 2.5 years. And in one of your December episodes about muskox, you described it as just pulling an animal's name out of a hat and talking about how it's affected by climate change. Is that an accurate representation of the show?
Yeah, I think so. We do two types of episodes. The ones we've been doing for the longest since early quarantine when we started were deep dives, where we pick a specific topic and we go into how it affects the environment, the economy, health, justice, and then what are all the different solutions to whatever that issue is. And in those episodes, we also bring on a professor who researches the topic. We've had on professors from 15 countries and 6 continents, which has been incredible. And we've done well over 100 of those deep dive episodes. So they could be on anything. We've done a lot of animals. We've done a lot of foods. We've done a lot of specific fossil fuel projects around the world, which we can get into. Those are fascinating to me. We've done things like international accountability, ADHD, housing, the list goes on. And then our other episodes are called Tip of the Iceberg. Those started about a year ago, and they're basically a shorter episode where we break down whatever the big climate news story of the week was, kind of add some context around it. I tend to find there's always something missing from the conversation that I want to add. And then in the second segment, I'll answer a question from an audience member. And I'd love doing that, hearing what people are wondering about. So if any of your audience has climate questions, you can send them in to us and we'll get them on the show.
Heck yeah, that's great. And I love hearing that too. And it's just an interesting list that you ran through, you know, like the one that I have to ask about. So ADHD and climate change, how are those related?
That was way back. So hopefully I can remember this. I think ADHD is kind of, okay, so I'll start with, we did one on asthma as well. And that's actually fresh in my mind because of this whole gas stove conversation right now. Asthma is about 50% genetic and 50% environmental. So with the environment, there are various pollutants out there that can contribute to respiratory disease. ADHD was, I think, a higher percent genetic than environmental, but there are studies that have shown that certain pollutants can show up with ADHD symptoms. So the expert we had on that episode was Dr. Luz Claudio from the Mount Sinai Icahn School of Medicine, and she had done research on BTEX pollutants, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. Those 4 are neurotoxins and linked to ADHD-like symptoms. There are also ones that are more commonly discussed, like lead and mercury, which we've also done episodes specific on lead and on mercury, and those have effects on the brain as well.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And, you know, even thinking about like what we're seeing that happen with permafrost, right? Where things are melting and suddenly the chemicals that are in the soils that maybe not be great for people are now coming out. So it's really, really wild.
Yeah. And if you think about climate change, there's a number of ways. Of course, a lot of like trucks that will emit carbon dioxide are also emitting these BTEX chemicals. But you can even think about climate change creating natural disasters, which can come into communities that have toxic waste sites. And when that happens, the chemicals that are contained in one place can then be dispersed into the community. Or if you think about like your basement might have asbestos in the walls or lead paint and then gets flooded. And that, so there's ways that these pollutants can be dislodged due to climate change as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. And so the show is going really well. And obviously humor is a big part of that show. So do you consider yourself a comedian?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I actually ran my high school satire publication. And then in college, I ran our college satire publication for 2 years, along with my friend Maddie Schmidt, who's now working on the Sweaty Penguin as well. And in those 2 years, we were able to grow it from actually just myself when I took over. It was freshman year and the current editor-in-chief was kind of bored of it and was like, hey, do you want this? And I was like, okay. Sure. And then everyone left. And we grew it to a 90-person team. We were doing daily articles. Wow. We actually won an award from the university I won Outstanding Student Activities Member of the Year, which was really cool. So that was an amazing experience. And Maddie's got a lot of the comedy chops, so she taught me a lot. I was more the manager and idea person, I guess. But I do love comedy writing. I did a lot with my film and TV major and learned a lot from that experience. And so going into The Sweaty Penguin, I felt comedy is a great tool to make something that's overwhelming into something less overwhelming. And that's a lot of what satire writing is about too. And so, of course, I wanted to use that for climate change, given that I had always found that overwhelming in my early days.
Ah, that's so fascinating. And gosh, I have 1,000 more questions. So I have to give you some credit, like trying to starting from zero and getting to 90 people is incredible. That's not easy. So how on earth did you do that?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think a lot of what it was is in our first semester, it was maybe got to like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 of us. And basically we would just have writers meetings where we would come in, everyone would write an article in that room, and then we would publish them throughout the week. So pretty quickly we were up to 3 or 4 articles a week just with that small group. And I think that putting out a level of consistency, getting people to recognize like, oh, they're doing good work. Then the next year, we put out like a writing application, and I think probably like 20 people signed up just with that, seeing what we were doing. And some of the people who we had on originally, I was able to move into editor roles. And then we kind of got going that semester. Then at the end of that semester, we had people from that pool who we kind of moved into editor roles. And I think it was around then we actually, the founder of, it's called The Bunyan, the satire publication, the BU Onion, the founder didn't want to be affiliated with the university because for obvious reasons, you don't want to be taking funding from them if you're satirizing them. But I was able to find a loophole where we could be recognized that we exist and go to the club fair and book classrooms, but not receive funding. So I was able to get us registered in that capacity. And then at the club fair, when there's tens of thousands of students coming through, we meet a lot of people. We built up an email list. People started joining. And by the end, we'd have like 53 applicants for 14 writer spots. Like, it was pretty amazing to see how many people wanted to be a part of it.
That's awesome. That's great.
That is really awesome. I feel like, and I would wonder if that would be different now after COVID. I feel like it's hard to get students to sign up for things from what I've heard from other students I work with, but maybe when you have just such a cool thing like that, people still gravitate towards it. It's really awesome.
Yeah. You'd have to ask them. I was helped by COVID, but I'm sure it's a bigger challenge.
Well, that's all really cool. And so you talked about Tip of the Iceberg, which is a shorter breakdown that you have, and the deeper dives. And so do you feel like you're really getting the messages across to the right people? Have you getting good feedback?
I hope so. I have been really encouraged by a lot of the recognition we've received. I was mentioning before we got on, we just won a Signal Listener's Choice Award this week, awesome, which I'm thrilled about. We are now a Solutions Journalism Network Climate Beacon newsroom. That's the first inaugural version of this initiative where we were selected along with Grist and Telemundo and Sacramento Bee and Washington Informer and a great group of newsrooms who are working on climate and trying to better their climate solutions coverage. So we'll be working together over the next year to kind of improve each other and then hopefully have lessons to share with the larger community. So there's been a lot of recognition like that I've been so excited about. But I think what gets me most excited is talking to people who are not as engaged with climate change for whatever reason, be it political, be it anxiety, and actually bring them into the conversation. Because like I said, there is a lot more nuance to the issue. There's a lot more critical thinking. Not everything is politics. And if we can just kind of introduce them to climate change and make them start thinking about it, that's such an important step. So I hope that we are continuing to succeed in that effort.
Yeah, it's a really great thing that you're doing. And you also do an Ask Me Anything. So just curious if there are specific issues or questions that you get asked a lot in those.
I think they're different every time, which is great. I did do a mailbag episode around New Year's Eve because I didn't want our editor to have to work that week. And I've had a few questions saved that were a little more on the, I guess you could say, skeptical side. I think they were well-intentioned, but asking like questions about how real is climate change and questions about certain energy sources and what the drawbacks of renewable energy might be, or like things like that. And I had a lot of fun going through those questions because I think very often they do just start an argument, and that's not how I roll. I looked at them and I was like, okay, let's assume this was in good faith. I'm sure it was. And let's actually break this down because people just might not know. And so I was explaining down to the molecular level, like how the greenhouse effect actually works. You have two carbon atoms and an oxygen atom. And when infrared radiation hits it, the oxygen atom kind of isolate or wobbles, and that creates energy. And then it's sort of like this pinball machine where when you have more of them in the atmosphere, there's more infrared radiation bouncing from one to the other. So actually getting into the weeds like that, I think, was really fun. So those are, I guess, some of the more memorable questions for me, but we do get a lot.
Awesome. And you know, how are you getting those people to engage who, you know, might not be believers or whatever? Do you feel like they're starting off like trying to defend their own viewpoints, and then, you know, they're looking for a debate, but then you obviously have your tactics for making it a worthwhile conversation. But how are you able to, are there any other tactics, I guess, that you're using to engage people to pull them into the conversation that they were afraid to or not willing to have?
Yeah, I think for me, a lot is just, I'm a very curious person and I want to learn why they think what they think, really more than anything else. And so going into the conversation that way already kind of prevents any debate, because I'm not going to try. I just want to know where they're coming from. And if I can help move them in a better direction, I will. But I'm not feeling a pressure to do that. From there, I think there's a tactic called disagreeing agreeably that I learned from a Dale Carnegie course, where basically, first off, you want to avoid the word but at all costs, or any fancy buts, like however, although, all that. One of my classmates called it a butt in a tuxedo. Right. But then what you do is you repeat back what they said, and if you need to actually confirm, like, so this is what you're trying to say, and that shows that you heard them and you listened to them and you internalize what they said. Then you present whatever evidence you might have. And then at the very end, you state your viewpoint. And if you're not using those but words, it almost doesn't feel like you're getting disagreed with. It feels like, yeah, we're on the same page and here's what I want to add. And very often you can be on the same page. I think people forget there's no one who doesn't want clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment. It's we need that to live. It's right, pretty basic. And from there, if you look at the economy, our economy is built on things from our natural environment. So you can go down a list and see that there's a lot of room to have common ground. And then I just can peel back a little bit until I find where that common ground is and then go from there. There's so much more to it as well. I think people very often, when they get overwhelmed by the politics or the solutions, they might shut down and just try to deny a problem exists. But once you present solutions that they might feel a lot more comfortable with, they will immediately jump on the same page about the problem. So literally just an hour ago before we hopped on, I was recording a TikTok about this gas stove situation where people are hearing about the prospect of gas stoves getting banned and immediately jumping to say, no, we love gas stoves. And I was saying, okay, there are issues. Gas stoves do leak methane, which is a greenhouse gas that's 28 times higher global warming potential than CO2. Gas stoves do contribute to asthma, depending on the pollutants that they release. They don't cause it, but they contribute. Gas stoves are also just tougher to clean, and they don't cook as well as an induction stove, according to chefs. And they also leak methane when you're not even using it. So if you're not having your ventilator on 24/7, you're getting those pollutants out. So there are facts there. But at the same time, bans are not the only option. You can look at market incentives for new homes. I had the idea this morning, I wonder if you could not just vent the carbon, but figure out a way to actually capture it the way a scrubber would at a power plant. I'm not sure. I just had the idea. But there's so many different options. And I think once you present those options, then people can see, oh, maybe I like that solution. And then all of a sudden, all these facts don't seem so daunting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And oh gosh, gas stoves, they terrify me. I grew up without them. Mm. And every time I come into a home and someone's like, oh, just use the gas. I'm like, you want me to use this thing? I feel like I'm going to blow your house up. So not only do they have pollutant hazards and all that, but I feel like, man, the fire hazards, I just don't get it. But, you know, I think there comes with a certain amount of romanticism. Our parents might have used them, or, you know, we feel like this is the way I've always done it, and I like it this way. So I think it's hard for people to give up those traditions.
Yeah. And again, I mean, the way I started the TikTok today, I was like, the best argument I've heard in favor of gas stoves is, shut up, I like gas stoves. That's fine. You can like something and you can say, I don't want this taken away from me. But you also, there are facts out there, and we can talk about, okay, if you want to keep gas stoves, then how do we want to move forward on these issues? We don't have to, those don't have to be two of the same. We can separate that out and say, okay, what do we want to do to make gas stoves safer if, in fact, you want to continue using gas stoves? But I am hearing from every expert on cooking that induction stoves are not the crappy electric stoves. They actually provide direct heat as opposed to indirect heat, which cooks food better. So I'm happy to listen to that if that's what they say.
Yeah. Well, for example, I was cooking a grilled veggie burgers at my boyfriend's dad's house a week ago, and he has a gas oven, gas range, whatever. And he had to light it for me. I'm not going to lie. And it just like, it's either on or it's off. So it's either like burning the thing, it's on fire, or it's off. You know, whereas your induction, you can set it at a nice temperature, low, high, medium. I don't know. Someone can send me an email and argue why I need a gas oven. But I think it's a parallel argument with like electric vehicles, right? I want my motorized car and I want to hear it and I want to feel the power and all those things. But then you got to ease it people into the options and give them the options. So I think your approach there is spot on.
Yeah, for sure.
So over the years doing the podcast, do you have any of your most favorite? I know that Nick and I don't really feel like we want to call it our favorites like our children, but do you have any particularly good memorable episodes that if someone was going to jump off of here and go check out, maybe direct them to some good ones? Of course, they're all good. I know that. I enjoy the ones I listen to.
Except for the very early ones when I was in my parents' basement during quarantine.
Yeah.
It's gotten good. I think I'll think of a few. The one that is obviously most memorable would be episode 100, because we did a live recording at a comedy club in Hollywood, which was so much fun. The episode was on penguins, unsurprisingly, and it was just so great to have a in-person experience for the first time. One that I think was just such a clean episode and also had a lot of interesting angles was our episode on bees. I found that there was so much in there, but there's actually an issue of beehive heists in Northern California, because basically California has like all the almonds in the country and most in the world, and almonds need bees to pollinate them. And so every year around the same time, all the beekeepers in the country send their bees on trucks out to California to pollinate all the almonds for 6 weeks. And there's been issues of people literally stealing beehives around the almond trees. And that was just fascinating to me. There was also another whole issue with, I think it was Chinese honey being diluted with rice vinegar or something and undercutting American honey in the US market. So there was just so much in there that was interesting to me. Another thing I would recommend, we have a lot of episodes on carbon bombs, which are specific fossil fuel projects. So this goes back to last May, The Guardian published an investigative report where they were looking at future planned oil and gas exploration around the world. And they were trying to understand what all was planned, because that's not necessarily publicly available data. And what they found is, of the big fossil fuel companies in the world, they had planned 195 oil and gas projects that would be called carbon bombs, which means they would emit over 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide over the course of their lifetime. And for context, in 2019, I believe the entire world emitted like 59 billion tons of carbon dioxide. So 1 billion for one project is a lot. And they found 195 of these projects planned around the world, which together would emit 646 billion tons of carbon and kind of blow past our 1.5 degrees Celsius climate goal. And that kind of freaked me out when I heard that. And, yeah. But I was kind of like, okay, my job is to make this less overwhelming. What do I do? And so I decided, all right, let's take this one by one. And why I thought that was possible, I don't know, but I, we started picking specific projects off the list and seeing, all right, what's going on here. And what I've found is each project really has its own issues, its own nuances. Obviously, there's a lot of common threads you might see, but they're very different. And what we find because of that is there's a lot of different solutions in each community, and the communities themselves are very different. Sometimes the community is largely people who love the industry being there, and we think about, all right, how can we get them new jobs, or how can we make the industry safer? In other places, it's literally on indigenous land, and we're talking about how do we preserve their rights to hunt fish and gather. So I found those issues fascinating to actually break down each individual community. And it gives me a lot of hope to see that in each of these cases, there really is a viable and sensible path forward. So if you look to episodes like the Montney Formation this last week, which is in Canada, the Orinoco Belt, which is the big oil field in Venezuela, the Rovuma Basin, which is a LNG project in Mozambique. We've also done several in the United States, like the Permian Basin, Haynesville Shale, Bakken Formation. So yeah, there's a lot of those. And I think the titles might be like, huh, what's that? But they're really interesting and insightful. So I hope you'll check them out.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's fascinating. And you know, finding projects like that and then finding the nuances to them. And honestly, from the interview, I just love the, basically our theme today is be curious, right? And that'll take you lots of different places. And one of the things we love to do is ask people about the job that they do. So this is what we call field notes for the show. And so we like to ask about memorable moments of people in the environmental industry doing their job. And we are encouraging our guests, our listeners, to share their stories with us, hashtag field notes. Ethan, do you have a memorable story of you doing your job and taking you to a place where you never thought you'd be, or just, you know, learning something kind of amusing or fun that you want to share with us?
That's a good question. The thing that jumped into my head first is kind of an anti-story. So I, going into quarantine, or well, before that, so January 2020, I was applying for a study abroad program for the next summer in Kenya and Tanzania, where I'd be doing a month learning about wildlife conservation. It was an intense application. It was like 8 500-word essays or something. And so it took me a few weeks to do. I got it in and I got accepted and I was so excited. And then quarantine hit and it didn't happen. Aww. And I was devastated, understandably. Uh-huh. And I had actually tried studying abroad earlier in college too. There was a Antarctic research program and that got blown up for reasons I won't get into here. It was a national news story if you want to look it up. But yeah, so I had really tried to study abroad in college and do a really cool experience twice, and both times it didn't happen. But quarantine led to the Sweaty Penguin. It probably would not have happened without it. And I guess as we were getting going, I was reflecting on the fact that, I'm sure you're familiar with the preservation versus conservation conversation. Preservation would be leaving land intact and kind of protecting it that way, whereas conservation is more, how do we use resources in a sustainable way where we can continue to use them in the future? And I've always tended to lean in more of a conservation direction. And I was not really an outdoorsy person growing up. So learning about climate change was very much a me concern and other human concern. It was less so about just the sanctity of nature, if that makes sense. And so I wonder sometimes, I think that that approach has been part of what's led me to reach out to a lot of people, because I think a lot of people do feel that way, that we need to preserve the environment to the extent that it helps us, but it doesn't have to be perfect. And I wonder, had I gone on one of these trips and just seen these beautiful landscapes, if I might have ended up being swayed and thinking, oh no, we have to leave everything perfect, we can't do anything, and that may have cut into my message down the line. So I still wish I had those experiences, but I do think that I was shaped by the fact that I didn't. And so that's why I call that a anti-story, but that's where my brain went.
No, it's wonderful. And I think it's very fair to say too, you know, a lot of, you know, the world we have is very dynamic, right? We want to put it in boxes all the time, and all the time that changes, you know, no matter what we try to do conceptually, sometimes it's very, very hard to do. So I think it's fascinating. I think it's a great story. So I appreciate that for sure. And you have to, I guess I want to ask about your public engagements as well. Kind of, you know, we've had people on the show that are great at public speaking, you know, offering advice on ways to do that. But do you have any memorable moments of maybe where something didn't go the way you had planned and how you used to deal with that?
I think I've had challenging conversations in the sense of someone just didn't want to listen. Like they just kind of wanted to talk at me and shoot down what I was saying. And it doesn't happen a lot. And it actually happens from both sides. It's not a liberal or conservative thing. But I will say I've had a lot of great opportunities to appear on shows that are both liberal and conservative, and very much so in both directions. And I struggle to think of any time where I felt like it was unproductive. I've had shows where I felt that wasn't my best. There was one that came out recently where I was running on like 2 hours of sleep, and I was in the middle of my move to LA, and they asked a question that I think was like, do you really believe that humans can change the environment that God created for us? And I get those questions sometimes, and normally I'm quick to answer, but that day I was a little off and I wasn't as happy with my answer. But like, I think that for the most part, those conversations go amazingly well. I think we have so much more common ground than we realize. And the fact that I have so much faith in that, I think makes even the more challenging conversations or ones where we might seem like we're a lot further apart actually turn out to be very productive and insightful. So I look forward to doing more of those in the coming weeks, months, years.
Well, that's great. I like the use of faith in that scenario. So we've learned about your podcast and your writing and a little bit of the comedy. What do you do for fun? What do you do when you're not doing the Sweaty Penguin or trying to help people laugh their way through climate change?
Yeah, well, I'm a big Pittsburgh Steelers fan. I listen to like 80 podcasts a day.
All right. You can come back anytime. All right. We're good.
Yeah. Are you as well?
Yeah. Of course.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very bittersweet end to the season there, but yeah, I'm super excited for next year. Yeah, I also have a home aquarium, which I'd love. I need to go get some more fishies and shrimps soon. I have 3 cardinal tetras in there right now. I have a whole story with that if you want. And then I love grilling. I love cooking and baking, and I am famous around here for entertaining. I put on my TikTok a whole spread that I made for the FIFA World Cup final because it was 7 a.m. our time and I had friends coming over. So I wanted to make like breakfasty appetizer foods. And so I made bacon roses. I made like bite-size sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles. I made a whole awesome spread. So that's one of my favorite things. Yeah, I ran track and cross country in high school. I get shin splints now, but I still love running. I just can't really do it very much.
You're so, just like, oh, fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I do that for a week and then I'm like, yeah, I'll try again in a year. But I do miss it a lot. So
awesome. Well, it's still early in the year. We're still in January. So what's on deck and any new adventures for you this year?
Yeah, we're really excited to be a part of this Climate Beacon Newsroom initiative. As part of it, a lot of what we're focused on is growing our TikTok. I think that TikTok is such a great platform to reach young people, to be our silly selves and to provide some quick information on climate. We're also looking at educational resources, how we can support professors and teachers. This was inspired by the fact that over at the University of Kansas, there's a professor, Shannon O'Lear, who's hopefully it will launch this semester. She's been working for the last like year to put together a geography course where instead of the textbook, they'll be using the Sweaty Penguin. And we're thrilled about this. I think it's the most flattering thing that's ever happened to me. And she very smartly was just like, yeah, they don't read the textbook, so I need to give them something they'll enjoy. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how that class turns out and if we can collaborate with them to make that something that other universities do as well. And then I guess in addition, I'm working hard to come on more TV and radio and podcasts and talk about what we're doing. I have been writing a lot of op-eds, which are really exciting to see my work published in other places as opposed to just posting it myself. So we'll see where all this goes. Ultimately, my goal is to make the biggest impact possible, help people engage with climate change, feel less overwhelmed, make it less politicized. And however I can do that, I'm glad to do it.
Well, that's awesome. Thanks for joining us today and talking about all this. Before we let you go, is there anything else that you would like to talk about?
Well, I'll just say if you want to find the Sweaty Penguin, we are on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We're at thesweatypenguin.com. If you want to support the show further, you can sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. You can get merch, bonus content, a bunch of cool stuff. We were just talking before the show about how hard monetization is. So we really, really appreciate when people do that. And then, yeah, if you have any climate questions, let us know. You can comment on our social media. You can email me. You can send it via Patreon. We'll be more than happy to get them answered on the show.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us, Ethan. This has been a lot of fun. And have a great year.
Yeah, you as well. Thanks for having me.
That's our show. Thank you, Ethan, for joining us today. Please be sure to check us out each and every Friday. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Bye.
See you, everybody.